What's up, world? I'm Matt Newberg from Hungary, and this is The Feed. Each episode, we'll dive into conversations with the industry insiders who are leveraging technology to shape the way we eat.
On today's episode of The Feed, I sat down with Carl Stenmark, general partner at VMG, a hybrid consumer growth equity and software venture fund with over $1.2 billion in committed capital. The fund has backed names like Spindrift, Stone Brewing, and Kind on the consumer side, and We, Afresh, and Swell on the software side. In this episode, we'll chat about how VMG leverages its software investments to help its portfolio brands, the state of valuations for CPG and tech startups, and the future of personalization and sustainability. Alrighty, I'm very excited to be live from the grocery shop floor in Las Vegas, Nevada, joined by Carl Stenmark. He's the general partner at VMG Partners, a 17-year-old private equity and venture firm investing in early stage and growth, tech-enabled consumer food, beverage, personal care, and household brands, as well as the infrastructure powering them. And prior to VMG, Carl was an associate at Summit Partners, where he diligenced companies in the energy, green building, and smart grid sectors. Carl, great to have you on board.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
I'm always curious kind of to start with kind of understanding the path to investing for a lot of people. Some people come from the operations side. How did you get to VMG and investing in
companies? Yeah, that's a great question. I took a unconventional path, but a very lucky one. So I went directly into investing out of undergrad, which was at a firm, as you mentioned, called Summit Partners. And so it was one of the few private equity or buy side shops that hires right out of undergrad. And it, you know, big part of the role is dialing for dollars. And at that time, there was a lot less technology helping you source, but going through a lot of magazines and calling a lot of CEOs and getting hung up on a decent amount, but learned a ton. And then ultimately made it through to VMG, I guess in a little bit of a roundabout, but somewhat direct way. So, initially went to business school after Summit thinking that I would transition to the operating side and actually did a stint at O-Power, because I was passionate about energy efficiency, but then missed some of that high-paced nature of investing. So was really seeking an opportunity to get back into investing, but in a role that was much more focused on value add and working really closely with the portfolio companies that we partnered with. And, recalled actually meeting Kara, one of the founding partners at VMG, at a conference like this. It was actually Global Pet Expo, as I was, evaluating one of their first companies called Wagon Train, which was a dog treat business. And as Summit, we were wanting to potentially invest. They ultimately sold to Nestle, so we didn't win that process. But through that, got to meet Kara, and what really stood out was she was on the show floor, handing out dog treats, talking to me and everybody else about the company as if she was an executive team member, and that's just something that was very unique, but really exciting because to me it blended that nature of, hey, we can actually provide impact to the companies that we are investing in, but have the opportunity to still invest in multiple businesses and have exposure to multiple business models. So during business school, reached out to her, randomly caught up. They had just closed Fund 2. And we're looking to add team members and got really lucky and turned a cold call into a job and, have been with VMG ever since, which is a little over 10 years now.
Love it. Very fascinating. And kind of love that approach of, you see somebody that's like acting like they're a part of the company. I mean, they really are a part of the company. They shouldn't be this like passive
investor. Exactly. I mean, I think she knew more about the business than probably most team members, and yeah. It was just really impressive.
Love that. You've invested in a lot of interesting companies on the consumer side. So, we got Spindrift and Illegal Mezcal, Justin's, Daily Harvest. If you look at kind of what is the common thread of some of these companies on both the early stage side and on the growth side, are there any kind of common threads there?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think the primary thing that we look to evaluate is consumer evangelism. And so a lot of people say that's NPS. Others say it's really around engagement and community. There's a lot of ways to get at it, but ultimately, whether it's early stage or growth stage, what you're looking for is end consumer love for that brand. And that translates into organic acquisition, that translates into high velocity at shelf, that translates into high repeat if it's online or high retention. But it's really about how is a brand emotionally resonating with its end consumer and how does that show up in the data? I think unfortunately or fortunately with a lot more data available now than before, it's easy to really look at point in time statistics. You know, a number of investors get really hung up on looking at, you know, just ROI or LTV over CAC, for instance. And I think one of the challenges with those metrics are they are in fact point in time metrics. And, you know, CACs, as we've seen with the IDFA changes, can increase drastically. And unlike software, consumer doesn't have any switching costs. And so looking at long-term LTV is very difficult. And rather, where are you seeing consumer behavior in that underlying purchase behavior of a particular brand? And how are they talking about that brand with their friends and family on their social communities, et cetera, which gives you an indication of, you know, the amount of organic acquisition that they will achieve going forward, which is allows you to build a very capital efficient business. I think as we look at both technology and consumer, you know, there's different metrics, but on the consumer side, which you mentioned, it's really about how does this drive cash flows. I mean, that's what all these businesses end up getting evaluated on when you go to exit. And, you know, I think a lot of high growth businesses discount that. And what we're trying to assess is, you know, in 4 to 5 years when we go to sell these businesses, are they going to be generating a decent amount of cash? Because that will give you the most optionality in terms of your opportunities to monetize that asset.
It's a winning strategy in this market that is definitely very, very scrutinizing yeah. cash flow.
It's back to being in vogue. For the last few years, it wasn't as sexy, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I really love what you're saying about, you know, the organic side, right? It's like, you know, we may have tumultuous periods in the market where, or even just idiosyncratic things where, like you mentioned, certain changes make... you know, acquisition harder for across the board for everyone. How are you going to ride that storm over the long haul? And that's really about building that relationship with the customer. VMG, Velocity Made Good, is kind of what it stands for, right?
Yep.
Is there a tie-in to what you just mentioned and what you were saying around velocity?
There is. I mean, it's interesting. It's a sailing term. None of us sail. But I think what we liked about it was that it's, you know, the fastest path between point A and point B is not a straight line. And that's indicative of, you know, most journeys. We've been fortunate enough to partner with a number of very successful brands that have had tremendous exits. But in each of those, it's never been a straight line path. You know, there's going to be bumps along the road. And candidly, that's where we get most excited to dig in. And it's those challenging times where we very specialized in both consumer and in software and the verticals we play in. And that allows us to have great pattern recognition. And so when founders are struggling with an issue, hopefully we can come with resources and examples of how to overcome that. You know, business, you never have the exact right answer, but we can ask the right questions, provide the right resources to help overcome the inevitable obstacles that any brand will face. And I think that's what's really telling about Velocity Made Good and why we went with that name versus somebody's initials or anything like that.
Victor M. Gordon.
Exactly.
Okay. Got it. Yeah. Awesome. So love to talk about like portfolio construction or and this kind of barbell approach, you know, about how you invest in like earlier stage companies alongside the growth. Are those growth investments all new companies? Are they follow-on? Talk to us a little bit about that strategy.
Yeah, I mean, I think strategy always is evolving, but most of our growth investments, and the name is a little bit of a misnomer. We really have two vehicles. One invests in CPG products as well as consumer services. And so that's our, what we today label VMG growth. We're going through a rebranding exercise ourselves. And we're stage agnostic when it comes to brands and services. We tend not to do seed stage or very early, because I think we pride ourselves in delivering a lot of resources, and thus we need to have a concentrated portfolio. Any given fund, we might invest in 10 to 12 brands. And the purpose of that is so that we can devote a significant piece of our time to partnering with those brands, which prevents us from doing a lot of very early stage businesses. But, you know, Spindrift, for example, was sub $10 million when we invested, and it was a small check. We've since grown that check, and that business has since grown extremely well. I guess to answer your question a little bit more directly, we have somewhat of a barbell approach to get us to portfolio concentration. And so we've made a few $100+ million investments and a few sub $20 million investments. And that allows us to invest $850 million, but into 10 to 13 brands. On the earlier stage side of things, we probably play a little bit earlier when it comes to consumer technology. And so, you know, we have done some seed investments on that side. Our primary focus is Series A. And Series B on the consumer technology side. But with that, we've done a lot of follow-ons. And so we want to become stage agnostic there as well, where we'll invest from, you know, at Series A all the way to the Series D and really build our position over time.
Got it. Thank you. So I think this is a good time to kind of zoom in on Catalyst. So, which is, you know, as you hinted at, the tech side of the business of the portfolio. So you have a $400 million fund that's just dedicated to investing in technology that is powering kind of commerce for these brands. And I think what I'm most curious about is, in the same way that you are a value-add investor, how do your investments in these companies provide synergies for your portfolio on the other side of this $850 million consumer fund?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big reason why we created VMG Catalyst, was really taking a step back. And just as our companies must evolve to stay relevant, we have to, as a fund, evolve to stay relevant. Our end goal is obviously to be the best consumer investors out there. And we felt that in order to do so, we had to develop a technology practice. When I joined VMG, I had the fortune to work, you know, directly with Justin's and Baby Gannix, you know, 10 years ago or 9 years ago. And at that time, the tech stack really consisted of an ERP system. You know, fast forward to today, that's no longer sufficient for these growth brands to be successful. They have to have a more sophisticated tech stack. And we as investors have to help them navigate what they need to be implementing in order to put their best foot forward and to scale, you know, revenues non-linearly with headcount. And so, you know, 3 years ago, we formed the idea of VMG Catalyst, which, you know, we had already been evaluating a number of these technologies for our growth portfolio companies. And then we saw a lot of other venture capitalists end up investing and calling us for their diligence. And we said, hey, well, we have the best perspective because we have a very close point of view of the end customer. We understand the pain points better than most, so why don't we start to invest alongside this? We'll get really smart on these technologies. We'll be able to provide that information to our growth portfolio, who will then implement them and scale more efficiently as a result. And then on the Catalyst side, we're able to provide a lot of value because as these customers are thinking about their product roadmap, you know, we can provide them direct insight from their customers of what are the pain points that they're really facing and what types of products are really going to move the needle for them. And thus, how should they be really adjusting their product roadmap to really center around the voice of the customer? Additionally, for these early stage tech companies, purchasing software is different in the consumer space. If you're a software company selling to a software company, that typically involves a large RFP with a large engineering staff really digging deep into the code base. That's just not the case within consumer technology. You know, a lot of the evaluation process is what other logos are using that technology, and is that a logo that I trust? Is that a logo that has done well and that is viewed in the ecosystem as best in class or as admirable? And we feel like through our ecosystem that we've built over the last 17 years, we can help identify those logos that are going to be attractive to others and thus help with the go-to-market strategy of these consumer technologies by helping them early on in the Series A or seed or B secure those logos that will accelerate their go-to-market strategy moving forward.
Amazing. So it's like truly bi-directional. You know, it's like the technology companies are benefiting from your relationship. You can basically get them those logos, and then those companies are benefiting from the technology and then getting even better experience because they have a direct line of feedback back to the companies to say, okay, actually, we need you to do this for us. And maybe there's even a bigger market here for this particular thing that we didn't even know, that they didn't even know was a problem from the beginning.
100%. I mean, very synergistic. And that's where we've just realized, and why we're renaming it a little bit, but it's not a growth and venture fund in the sense that the venture fund will invest early stage and the growth will follow on later stage. We're renaming because they really sit side by side and they don't really overlap, but they provide each other with a ton of great advantages. And we felt that that was the move that was necessary for us to continue to be on the cutting edge of consumer investing and to maintain our leadership position as, you know, one of the best investors in the consumer space.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, I see that a lot on the restaurant side. You know, some of the more sophisticated restaurant groups, Chipotle, Inspired, are actually owning some more of the technology, right? And they're starting dedicated funds to not just become customers, but become investors, right?
That's right. That's right.
Is there, like, in the diligence process when you're evaluating a software company, are you able to use your brand portfolio to say, hey, we want you guys to, like, test this out? Or is that something that happens down the line once you've made the investment?
Yeah, I mean, 100%. And again, it's mutually beneficial. So I think what we have the advantage of doing is helping during an evaluation process, helping the software companies we're evaluating potentially acquire new customers because we are introducing them to, whether they're portfolio companies or just within our broader ecosystem, it doesn't really matter. And in exchange, we're getting feedback that is extremely helpful for our diligence, and the companies that we're diligencing are getting potentially great customers. And so it's super beneficial for both parties. One of the things we always have to be a little bit careful about, which I think some VCs do, you know, that can be frustrating, is just peddling their portfolio companies. And so what we typically do is identify a pain point and then try to do a market landscape of who is addressing that pain point. And so when we are going to potential end customers, we're more matchmaking than just trying to get a business development relationship. We don't want it to be transactional. Instead, it's, hey, we've had multiple conversations. We heard you're dealing with, you know, or looking for solutions around personalization. I'm having issues merchandising. I want, you know, some solutions around how I can better serve personalized merchandising up on my website. That we will go and take back and then provide, hey, not just one company, but hey, do the work for that end customer and say, we've talked to 30 businesses that are trying to solve personalization. We're a big fan of these three for these reasons. You know, let us know if you want an introduction to one or all three of them, and then would love your feedback. And that way, it's not a transactional relationship, but it really is in the hands of the brand to make the decision. We're just doing a lot of the pre-work for them. And then they're not just viewing us as, hey, these guys just want to, you know, peddle their portfolio company. And then, you know, you kind of break down that trust, which is so crucial in this space.
Kind of like is reminiscent of this idea of like customer discovery, right? Where you're like, and this is on the tech company side, right? You're trying to figure out you know, go to customers and you're not like a problem in search of a solution, right? You're trying to build something that people actually want.
Exactly.
This is like a Steve Blank-ism. So it's interesting, leading with that problem and then, okay, maybe there's 10 different companies that can fill that void. And
then I think it's helpful for the software companies we're evaluating, not just from a customer introduction standpoint, but from actually having a unique point of view. And so, you know, we talk about it as a team is going into a pitch or going into a conversation with a founder, we should be able to pitch their business as well, if not better than they are, because we've spoken to the customers and understand what exactly they're looking for and helping tailor that company's pitch to those customers because of our deep understanding of that pain point.
Interesting. I'd love to dig into some of those tech investments. Some of them I pulled out by name are Swell, Afresh, and Wee with an exclamation mark, which is actually, I think, is super cool. I guess, yeah, what were the theses that were behind those, each of those? If you had to come up with a short description of those problems and.
Yeah. So I'll probably tackle those one by one because I think it's a little hard to say what's the underlying theme on all three. We was our first investment out of those three. What stood out to us is, how back to evangelism, how efficiently they were acquiring their customers. We had deep relationships with the Instacarts of the world, the other online mainstream grocers. And I think you saw, customer acquisition costs becoming really high and a lot of competition. What stood out with we is that not only did we see a trend in ethnic food, scaling, but it was meeting the pain point of, hey, the alternatives within that category are typically a 99 Ranch or H Mart, some of the brick and mortar ethnic grocers, which tend to be outside of city centers and often 45-minute to hour drives for its customers. And when we was really focusing not just on being a technology company, but being a merchandising retailer that was providing a unique assortment that was very hard to find for its end customers in a really convenient way, they were able to acquire these evangelists that were then really telling their entire community about how much value this business was delivering, because they weren't providing a surcharge. They were providing the same prices as these brick and mortar retailers in exchange for overnight delivery. And so instead of same day, they were able to make their economics work and provide that value to their customer by doing next day delivery. And what this translated into at the time that we made the investment was, sub $5 CACs. And, that, along with the company being cash flow positive, was something that was very unique in that space, that we saw that it was a very unique product market fit because of those economics were so attractive. That was probably a longer winded answer of our thesis, but it's really, hey, it hit a pain point that was, I think, more acute than mainstream grocery. And that's why you saw its unit economics be much more attractive.
Yeah, that's insane.
Afresh, which is, here with us at this show, was hitting another pain point. So here it was more on the retailer side. Speaking of online grocers like we or Instacart or anything else, they have struggled with foot traffic. And, a lot of it is, how do we continue to encourage increased foot traffic and build basket with our end customers as we have increasing competition from online players? Well, what departments drive the most foot traffic? We believe it's the fresh departments. So produce, meat and poultry, et cetera, are, most critical to retailers, but the hardest to operate. High shrink or high out of stocks, and just very difficult to kind of control inventory and merchandise because they're not packaged UPC codes. They come in bushels, they come in boxes, they come in crates. How you order is so different. And what Afresh was able to do is provide a ordering software that really helped the end store managers better order this department, which created a better consumer experience. And so, you know, as you look at how you're going to differentiate as a retailer, it's often these perimeter of the store areas, and you have to wow the customer. And that is what Afresh enables its customers to really much improve their fresh departments that are much more in stock, fresher, higher quality produce, and at the same time save significant dollars. And so, you know, I think there's case studies of them improving their partners' fresh operating margin by 40%. And when you're talking about the volumes that these companies are, I mean, that's saving some customers over $100 million a year in savings by reducing shrink percentages.
We're talking about grocers are saving this.
Grocers themselves are increasing EBITDA over $100 million.
Right, and this is a 2-3%. You know, net margin business.
Exactly. So it has huge financial impacts, which obviously the CFO and, you know, public investors appreciate. But I think it also just has equally as important is, you know, the consumer experience is that much better for the areas of the store that are driving the traffic in the first place. And so that's one we're really excited about, just given our approach around omnichannel and thinking that, hey, offline grocery is not dead. It's very much alive, but there are efficiencies that can be gained through softwares like Afresh. The last one you mentioned is Swell. I think one of the overarching pain points, you know, that we see with brands is always trying to develop differentiated experiences. Going back to my first point around evangelism, that often that can be a byproduct of surprising and delighting your end consumer. Shopify did an amazing job, especially during the pandemic, helping companies get online fast. Now that every company is online, how do you differentiate? And it is our thesis that a headless backend like Swell provides businesses now the flexibility that they need to create differentiated customer experiences online without having to build an entire, you know, custom backend or development team themselves. Through a couple developers or through an agency partner, you're able to build very unique sites that are differentiated from your competition, which creates that surprise and delight factor that will, you know, prompt your end customers to tell others, which drives that organic acquisition and is really important. And so that's where we're excited about Swell driving what we're calling e-commerce 2.0.
Very cool. I'd love to talk about valuation for a second, because we're dealing with two very different beasts of companies, right? We're dealing with consumer companies selling atoms, and we're dealing with tech companies selling bits. And some of these bits are being transformed into atoms in some way, shape, or form. How do you think about, like, you know, in the peak of the market frenzy, I guess, post-pandemic, there's a lot of, I mean, we've seen it a lot, like a lot of CPG companies masquerading around to try to, you know, dress themselves up to make it look like they're a tech company, command a tech valuation, right? I guess, what did you see contributing to like those really high valuations on the CPG side? And where do you think that they should be? How do you look at evaluating those companies against something like Afresh or something like a Swell? And what are the kind of the dynamics that factor into these very disparate kind of ways of approaching valuation?
Right. A lot to unpack there, and it's always an art versus a science. I think, in my opinion, what drove a lot of the crazy valuations in these, you know, quote unquote tech CPG companies was growth. and what e-commerce and social media enabled brands to do for the first time was control their own growth, which accelerated growth exceptionally. So what I mean by that is the conventional route to market is really dependent upon retail resets. And so you have to sell into a retailer, get into the planogram, and then once you're there, it's your job to obviously, you know, increase your velocity, which will then in turn get you more shelf space, which will increase your assortment, and you keep your velocity, you're growing really quickly, and more retailers want to carry your product, and you continue to grow that way. E-commerce provided the ability to be less reliant on third-party retailers to sell your goods. Combined with social media and hyper-targeting allowed businesses to scale very quickly. And, you know, for in 2019, 2020, 2021, growth was valued higher than anything else. And I think that's where you really started to see some of those valuations creep up. You know, you look at where we are today, you know, the software multiples have cratered most significantly. I mean, things were trading at 40x on average almost and have come down to about 5x or 9x now. And CPG multiples have actually deteriorated much less significantly. And I think the reason behind that is, you know, historically, CPG has always been a staple in one's portfolio. And the reason being is these are all high cash flow, dividend paying businesses. And, you know, where we've touted on our growth side, and, you know, I think has resulted over the last 10 years in the most strategic exits in the CPG space, is that you need to drive profitability because that is what, you know, is valued. And when you have high growth or strong growth combined with strong gross margins and, you know, profitability, your multiples, well, they might not be 20 times like sometimes you see in software, are still very attractive. I think you're seeing 20 to 30 times EBITDA, which depending on the business can translate to 10 times revenue. And so those are still very attractive multiples. But I don't know if that answers it directly. It's hard to say because I think at the end of the day, some investors might have believed that these were tech companies that had high switching costs. But at the end of the day, we always believed that these are consumer companies that are leveraging technology and some better than others to deliver a much better consumer experience and a much better value prop. And that will result in higher consumer evangelism and higher growth, but still in profitability. And those will garner the highest multiples. And while it might not be some of these crazy software multiples, they're still very strong and still an ability to have really outsized returns. And listen, I think what's different between the two portfolios is if you drive a capital efficient business, you as the founder own a significant bigger piece of the pie. And so, well, you might not exit for $2 billion. If you own 50, 60% of a business that sells for $500 million versus 5% of a company that sells for $2 billion, it's still better off.
Right. I mean, is it safe to take some of this, what you've mentioned as kind of a, that there's more of an opportunity right now in the market as far as valuation when it comes to software? Are you seeing more opportunities there as far as getting good deals? Or
I guess what I'm saying is I'm pretty happy we're investing. And the reason I say that is that I think CPG has held up very well. So on our growth side of things, we're still seeing strong exits and, you know, our underlying businesses performing very well. On the software side, I think the end customers we're selling to are faring much better than some of the large software businesses. And so still selling into that piece of the market has been, well, harder this year, still not impossible. And so you're still seeing growth within commerce enablement technologies. And listen, I think, you know, when I was investing at Summit in 2008, 2009, VMG Fund One on the growth side was founded in 2006, 2007, and, you know, invested the majority of its dollars in 08, 09, and 2010. Both had amazing returns because I think you have the opportunity to pay more reasonable prices for great businesses. And then hopefully you not only grow those companies, but there is multiple accretion because, you know, I think we're all fingers crossed that this market rebounds in the coming years.
One of the things you mentioned, I guess, as we were talking about like the tech-like valuations of the CPG companies was this idea of like, okay, breaking free of the shackles of, you know, the retailing world and going at it, you know, on the D2C side and fueling it with social media and all these things. I guess you've invested in companies that are like pure D2C and you've invested in companies that are selling in retail. What are the common challenges that, you know, you see those companies face? And I guess if you zoom in on the D2C side, you know, what do you see? Do you see companies start to position themselves as more omni-channel, not necessarily wed to one specific model? You know, I certainly have thoughts of that, but would love to hear your thoughts on like, is D2C the same as it was?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, very timely question. I think for us, we've always been a big believer in omni-channel. And so, you know, with any of our businesses, it's always been on our roadmap to go into retail if it's a direct-to-consumer business or if it's a retail business to launch an e-commerce. And, you know, to answer your initial question directly, the challenges are the exact same. You know, fundamentally, it's the same. You're dealing with the same brand challenges to convince a consumer to purchase your product and try it, and then to hopefully deliver a product that will create repeat purchase. Whether, you know, you're selling online or through retail, you know, that challenge is exactly the same. Distribution has always been critical for growth. And, you know, there's always opportunities for arbitrage. And I think you saw 2017 to 2020, or through the end of 2020, amazing opportunities to efficiently acquire customers online. And, you know, that was probably in some cases more efficient than going through retail. 2022 has been a different story. And I think a little bit of it is due to some of the changes Apple's made and, you know, some of the privacy laws in general around IDFA, which has significantly increased customer acquisition costs. You've had transportation costs increase dramatically. And as a result, you're seeing a lot of our businesses shift a lot of their dollars to more focus on offline. And, you know, why I talk about omnichannel being so important is that you want to be flexible in where you're spending resources as an emerging brand. And, you know, again, in 2019, 2020, we shifted a lot of resources to our e-commerce channels. This year, you're seeing us, you know, pull back there and shift a lot more to retail. What does that mean going forward? You know, I think you're going to see businesses launch into retail that were direct to consumer much earlier in their life cycles. And, you know, really, e-commerce still is an amazing way, like I described, to launch your business. You get amazing first-party data on your customers, and you circumvent, you know, retailers that hold the keys to the kingdom in the past. Now, once you're able to prove traction, the retailers are going to want to carry your product, and then you can shift there. And thus, you can always make the decision, where am I getting the biggest ROI for my marketing dollars, for my trade spend, for my sales efforts? And, you know, right now it's retail. In 3 years, it might be e-commerce again. But building the capabilities to be successful in both is critical going forward.
Is there like a happy medium there? Because from my vantage point, I see a lot of food companies and we're starting out on D2C and you're looking at it and you're like, I don't want to buy a 6 month supply of this. The basket sizes don't make sense to justify
That's
the
right.
shipping costs, especially if you're trying to waive the shipping costs like for trial, right? Trial is so hard, even in retail where you have the customer walking in the store.
Food is very hard in direct to consumer because the margins aren't super high and your AOV is naturally much lower.
Right.
Because you know, trial and sampling is so important. And I think that's where there's been a few breakout successes in D2C. But then naturally, as you move past your early adopters, you know, people want to try the product before committing to large dollar spends. And the most efficient way to try the product is probably through an existing trip to a grocery store where you can buy one off. And, you know, once you have that customer, hopefully you create a membership or loyalty program to retain them on a efficient online, or ultimately, you know, the best businesses probably don't really care where you get the customer as long as they're setting up their channels to all be very profitable.
Got it. Yeah. I was thinking like, you know, something like GoPuff is something in between a, you know, they're not a traditional retailer, right? You can, and you have basket sizes where they could potentially work. I guess to the business, yeah. They look like a retail. It looks like a retail channel, right?
No, you're 100% right. I think you have GoPuff, you have Wee. You know, it's about discovery channels. And I think those are constantly evolving. Like, again, direct-to-consumer was a great discovery channel for a while. I think the GoPuffs and the Wees will be great discovery channels going forward. But so can offline retail. It's just changed. You know, 10 years ago, most of our brands started in specialty retail. So if you're a food business, you really get, especially natural food, you were getting discovered at Whole Foods Market or Sprouts. Costco all of a sudden became a great discovery mechanism. I mean, what they built their business model around is, you know, scavenger hunts of where do I find new and interesting products? And that's ended up being a great retailer for a lot of companies because they were able to allow customers to discover them there. And, you know, back to your question about how do you just get in an existing basket but still aren't lost in shelf, that can be quite hard to do, and you have to be very thoughtful about your channels of distribution so your early target customer can discover you in a way that's very efficient.
So I'm sure there's a lot of people who are going to listen to this and they're wondering what you're looking at as far as the next big shifts that you're going to see within technology that are going to really impact your portfolio on the consumer side. I'm wondering if you could share some of those things and maybe start with what you've seen over the last decade or so. You know, we've spoken to some of these things around customer acquisition and D2C, but like what have been like some of the biggest shifts that have been like the most tectonic shifts in consumer within as it relates to technology. And yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the past 10 years, it's easy. I mean, it's e-commerce. And I think it started with Amazon, you know, then followed by Shopify in combination with, you know, social media. And so the route to markets for a lot of brands evolved very quickly. I think what's interesting about the early days of e-commerce and what Amazon's always touted itself is that infinite shelf or product selection and availability. I think going forward, a lot of it is now going to be around personalization, curation, and, you know, hey, I'm carrying everything, but what does Carl really care about when he's coming somewhere? And how do you leverage data in a way that you're serving customers exactly what they want? So I think that's going to continue to be a big shift going forward. Another big piece is just efficiencies. And, you know, I think we're investing a lot in supply chain technology. And, you know, how are you allowing retailers or brands just to operate a lot more efficiently? And, you know, I think what's exciting about this space is that you're seeing an tremendous amount of innovation and purpose-built software geared towards this ecosystem. That didn't exist, you know, 5 years ago. It sure as heck didn't exist 10 years ago. And in fact, most of these retailers or brands had to try to customize legacy software that was built for other industries and tailor make them for the consumer space that was inherently broken. And I think a number of entrepreneurs have realized this, and wow, the consumer space is massive. And if I focus on grocery retail, I mean, given we're at grocery shop, that's most relevant, like where are their issues and what's going to drive? I mean, fresh technology, obviously we're biased with our investment in a fresh, but it goes well beyond just store level ordering software. It's really that full supply chain. And then you think about sustainability, everybody talking about, you know, we want net zero emissions, a lot easier said than done. And, you know, you're talking about a bunch of ESG initiatives. Well, E is very difficult because there's not a lot of data. And so I think there's going to be a lot of innovation around level three emissions and how do you actually help brands and retailers really accomplish these very aspirational goals.
Very interesting. In the U.S., how do you think consumers are weighing sustainability when it comes to purchasing decisions? And yeah, to kind of wrap up the conversation, like how do you define that? How important is it to you as a fund? And how critical do you think it's going to be to your portfolio going forward?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think when we think about sustainability, when we think about diversity, when we think about ethnic founders, I think there's a moral obligation to do things. But for these solutions to work, it also needs to make business sense. And I think as we look at these solutions, you know, whether it's food waste reduction, which obviously helps the bottom line of retailers or brands, if it's carbon emissions or getting your end product closer to the source, that reduces your transportation costs. And so I think ultimately the way we look at it is, hey, what is the consumer want, which is going to drive the dollars, but then does it still have ROI that it's going to receive significant investment? And these technologies are a lot still nascent, and so they're going to require investment, which requires ROI. And so it's finding that balance of what solutions out there are driving sustainability, but that are also driving strong ROI. And I will just say some anecdotes is like I think we're seeing that the Gen Z consumer especially is voting with their wallet. And sustainability really does change their purchase behavior. And I think that's probably the first generation that we've seen actually come through in purchase decisions. I think everybody, you know, other generations have always said this is important, but then when you really dig deep and look at purchase drivers, they're not willing to pay more for sustainability. And it never, you know, escalated to the top as much as it is with this Gen Z generation. So I do think that will also help with the ROI calculation because you're going to get higher top line revenue if you're driving sustainability initiatives.
If it doesn't make dollars, it doesn't make sense.
That's exactly right.
Carl, I've really loved this conversation, learned a lot. If companies want to pitch you, if people want to check out your portfolio, I just want to give you this space to plug away whatever it is you want to plug, as I do for every guest on the show.
No, appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, if you're an emerging CPG brand, you're an emerging consumer service, or you're an emerging technology selling into retailers, brands, distributors, et cetera, or large enterprises in the CPG space, we would love to hear from you. You can visit our website to see a little bit more about what we do, which is vmgpartners.com, or email me directly or anyone on our team. You know, our emails are all our last name at vmgpartners.com. On Stenmark at vmgpartners.com.
Amazing. Well, enjoy the rest of your show, and thank you so much for coming on.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you hear, please hit subscribe wherever you're listening to this podcast. And if you're curious to get a firsthand look at the cutting edge of food and tech, check out hungry.tv. That's Hungry with No You, where you can join in on live conversations like these or sign up for the free weekly newsletter.